Several years ago, we did a lectureship at Western Illinois University, and Farrell Till, who is a former Church of Christ preacher and now president of the Illinois Atheist Association, was attending. I'm going to take this off. I can't see my notes. And now I lost the mic. Here we go. And as we were having some discussion, one young man was there, and Farrell said to him, "Well, are you a disciple?" And the kid said, "No, I'm a Christian." And Farrell said, "Well, I'm glad to hear you're not a disciple. I guess you're just an atheist like me." And Farrell was right. Are you a disciple of Christ? That's an important question. See, I think one of the things we have done is that we have made the word disciple an office of the church. You know, we talk about preachers, we talk about deacons, we talk about elders. Where does disciple fit into that? It's one of those things where we have been allowed to be ignorant about what words mean and what they conveyed at the time of Christ and perhaps what they convey today or should convey today. The word disciple in the Greek literally means a trained one. A trained one. The disciples of Christ were not graduates of some seminary. They weren't, for the most part, highly educated people. Paul was, but Peter, nah, he's a fisherman. That's about the bottom of the totem pole. But he was still a trained one. And may I suggest to you, you are a disciple of something. My wife's two sisters are trained disciples. One of the Republican Party and one of the Democratic Party, which you can imagine is why we don't have Thanksgiving dinners together. Well, actually, it's the distance more than that. But disciple is used in that way in the political realm. There are those who are disciples of sports. They're trained. They can tell you the pedigree of everybody from Tom Brady to some insignificant defensive lineman. There are those who are disciples of fishing. My good buddy, Jim Harris Savage, always used to accuse him of being a fishing disciple. Well, that wasn't accurate for Jim. He was a disciple of Jesus, but he was also very highly trained in catching bluegill. Some of us are disciples of a personality, and boy, is that true in our culture today. Paparazzis are people who have become disciples of a public figure. They have their own magazines. They have their own television programs. There are some who are disciples of their job. We have a name for that. We call them workaholics. Jesus calls us to be his disciples. In a world where discipleship is offered in everything you can imagine, and maybe some things you cannot imagine, Jesus stands out uniquely. And it's interesting when we read Luke, the 9th chapter. You may want to turn there. When we read Luke, the 9th chapter, we see Jesus calling people to be his disciples. And it's interesting to see how people respond. And we have frequently misunderstood this passage. Luke 9, beginning with verse 57. First two verses. As they were walking along the road, a man said to him, "I will follow you wherever you go." And Jesus says, "Hey, man, foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head." You know, being a disciple may be uncomfortable for you, especially in our culture. In my 41 years in the public schools, I had many situations where people looked at me rather incredulously and said, "You believe in God? You're a Christian? What's the matter with you?" It wasn't comfortable being a disciple. How about you? Are you comfortable letting people know that you are a follower of Jesus Christ and becoming trained as a disciple? Next two verses. He said to another man, "Follow me." But the man replied, "Lord, first of all, let me go and bury my father." That passage has been misinterpreted because it's not in the present tense. The language there is future tense. What the guy was saying is, "Okay, Lord, I'll go with you as soon as my father passes away." Jesus said to him, "Let the dead bury their own dead. You go and proclaim the kingdom of God." You know, there's lots of things that can happen in our lives to call us to want to procrastinate becoming an active part of the church. "Well, I got some debts to pay." Yeah, don't we all? "Oh, yeah, but it will upset my mother." And believe me, I've been there. I was disowned when I said I believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. My parents said, "You're not my son anymore." Yeah, that's hard. That's tough. Continuing, still another said, "I will follow you, Lord, but first let me go back and say goodbye to my family." And Jesus replied, "No one who puts his hand to the plow looks back and is fit for service in the kingdom of God." See, that passage is present tense. It's not saying, "Yeah, somewhere down the road, maybe." It's saying, "Right now, I have to decide what my priorities in life are. What's important to me?" And breaking family relationships is hard, I know. But it's also interesting that these guys that Jesus is talking to are growing disciples. Notice the way in which that is worded is not somebody who had already been convicted about Christ. It's someone who is a new babe in Christ. Discipleship is a growing skill. And we have examples. How about Peter? Was Peter instantly a tower of strength? Well, you know the answer to that. He denied Christ 3 times. Later on, he had to be disciplined by Paul because he practiced racism. And Paul said, hey, you can't separate yourself from the Gentiles. Thomas doubted. Read Matthew 20. But he became a great missionary. Secular history tells us that Thomas ended up in the British Isles preaching to a pagan group of people. And Paul did not come out instant disciple. You know, I think sometimes we have a mistaken concept of Paul. Paul was a great man. Paul was a well-educated man. But Paul had to grow into discipleship, and so do I, and so do you. Listen to Galatians 3. This is Paul talking. But when God set me apart from birth and called me by his grace, was pleased to reveal his son in me so that I might preach him among the Gentiles, I did not consult any man, nor did I go up to Jerusalem to see who were apostles before I was. See, Paul did not have an inherited discipleship. He was not a disciple because his mom and dad were disciples. So how do you get it? But I went immediately into Arabia and later returned to Damascus. Then after 3 years, I went up to Jerusalem to get acquainted with Peter and stayed with him 15 days. You say, I don't have enough knowledge to be a disciple. Oh yeah, yeah you do. You have more than Paul did. I mean, Paul went into isolation. He struggled with the change he was about to make. Discipleship is something you grow in. And let me point out a couple of things to you. Number one, we do not want to be casual disciples, like the ones we just read about. Christianity doesn't work in spasms. In Acts 2 and verse 46, as we look at the description of the early church, it says, every day they continued to meet together. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God. This was a daily activity. Why has the congregation invested in this little book? Why have we done that? I hope you got a copy. If you haven't, there's some on the table here. If you are on Zoom, let me know you'd like it, and I'll mail one with your bulletin. See, what power for today is a daily opportunity to grow. A daily activity like the first century church. We cannot sit back and assume that somehow we're going to, by osmosis, become active disciples. Hebrews 10 and verse 25 says, let us not give up meeting together, as the habit of some is. Let us encourage one another, and all the more as you see the day approaching. You say, well, I don't like to go to church and listen to you. I understand that. But that's not where you gain your knowledge. And that's not where you gain your stimulus. I like to get here early before church so I can be encouraged by those of you who come early. I like to stay after and be encouraged by those of you who stay after. I like to talk on the phone. Every now and then Bill Solomons will call me up Every now and then, I'll call one of our old buddies. Sometimes they have things they want to talk about. I called Adele Durham, who some of you know. She's been part of our senior group for a long time. She's in a nursing home in South Bend. I always love to talk to her because she's always got something to say. Always an encouragement. Sometimes a complaint. This last week she had a complaint. She had an ulcer on her foot. The nurse came in and did the wrong foot. Well, if you know Adele, you know where that went. But we got onto the discussion of what's important. You know, I don't understand how anyone expects to survive when their entire nourishment spiritually is 60 minutes one day a week. You know, that's like saying, okay, I've decided I'm going to go on a diet. I'm going to eat on Saturday instead of Sunday, once a week. Not going to eat anything the rest of the week. Oh, yeah? What's going to happen if you do that? Don't you see that's what happens to us spiritually as well? Find a way by the telephone. Find a way by periodicals. Find a way to be a growing, learning, trained disciple. In 1 Corinthians 11, beginning with verse 28, we read about one of the things Jesus instituted to help us be active disciples. To help us so that we would be those who are trained. Trained. Do you remember that passage? Of course you do. It's quoted every time we have communion. A man ought to examine himself before he eats of the bread and drinks of the cup. For anyone who eats and drinks without recognizing the body of the Lord eats and drinks judgment on himself. This is why many of you are weak and sick. And some of you have just fallen asleep. You're dead. Communion is not a ritual. It's not a ritual. Communion is one of those things we can do to build our discipleship. One of those things we can actively participate in. And I'm afraid sometimes we partake of the communion too casually. We can't be trained ones without a conscious immersion into the meaning of the death, the sacrifice of Jesus. And I know sometimes that's hard. I mean, I had three kids. I know what it is to have a squirming one-year-old in your lap and trying to partake of the communion and having your mind in the right place when the kid throws up. I've been there. But we cannot be casual about our Christianity. As a disciple, we need to be ones who are learning, who are growing, who are becoming stronger. I would also encourage us not to be calculating callous disciples. Christians for personal gain. That's less of a risk here than it is in most congregations. I'm glad we don't have a full-time paid preacher. By the way, I'm not paid anything. You say, well, you're not worth it. That's not the point. Because one of the things that we have to understand is that there are many people out there who are calculating callous disciples or claim to be. They start out with Judas. Luke 22:5 says they agreed to pay him some money. And Judas was in a period of low faith. His discipleship was very weak, and the money looked good. In Acts 8, beginning with verse 9, we read about a guy named Simon Simon was a religious scam artist. Any of those around today? Turn on your television set. Turn on your TV. Pick up your newspaper. Religious scam artists are everywhere, promising all kinds of things. We have people who are preachers because they can't do anything else. I had a preacher tell me that one time. Or because it's the easy way out. If you're a minister in the biblical sense, that is so far from truth. And then there are those who are just simply socially promoting by their religion. The classic example, Ananias and Sapphira in Acts 5, beginning with verse 1. With his wife's full knowledge, Ananias kept back part of the money for the property he sold for himself and laid it at the apostles' feet. That was a wonderful thing they did. They sold some property and gave a significant amount of the proceeds to the church. Ann Halford sent me an article that a Christian who had traveled in Africa sent about a visitation they made to a primitive tribe where there was a congregation. And the man and his son were out plowing a field. The son was pulling the plow and the man was guiding the plow. You ever tried to cultivate with just a push plow? And this man, member of the church, said to the person that guided him there, "That looks awfully hard." And he says, "Yeah. Yeah, they sold their oxen." And the guy, the American, said, "Sold their oxen? Why'd they do that?" "Well, they're building that new church building over there, and they wanted to give something to the building of the church building, so they sold their ox." And the American said, "Well, that's amazing. And they're out there plowing it by their hand." And they said, "Oh, don't feel sorry for them. They're rejoicing they had something to give." Oh, man. Ananias and Sapphira were disciplined by God. And the statement made to them was, "You didn't just lie to men, you lied to God. God knows what we give. He knows why we give. Do we count it as a joy, as a blessing, as a part of our worship?" I appreciated Bill's reference this morning to the fact that our giving was not part of the communion service. It's a separate religious act. And I thought he made that really clear. What a joyous thing, especially in our day and time, to be able to give to run the food pantry, to be able to minister to people in the community that are dealing with sickness. We cannot be callous, calculating disciples. And Jesus said in Matthew 6, beginning with verse 1, "Be careful not to do your acts of righteousness before men, so that you may be seen of them." See, that's what happened with Ananias and Sapphira. As a matter of fact, this passage in Matthew 6 was because what was happening in the Jewish worship was that the Jewish leaders were taking their 10% and they were waving it in front of everybody, making sure everybody saw that they were throwing their 10%, their tithe, into the contributing basket. So when you give to the needy, do not announce it with trumpets, as the hypocrites do in the synagogue. See, that's what was going on. And on the streets to be honored by men. I was walking in the Notre Dame library with Father Murphy, who was the Catholic priest in charge of my master's program. And in the lobby of the Notre Dame library, that's the one with the touchdown Jesus on it, there's a stand with golden plaques. Well, it's not real gold, but it's golden colored. And on that golden plaque, there is the name of everyone who contributed to the building of that library. And Father Murphy said, look at this. And he showed me that somebody had put double-faced tape on one of the plaques so that you couldn't look at the second plaque. You could only look at the first plaque. And they had taken chalk and highlighted their name. They wanted everybody to know they were a major contributor to the building of the Notre Dame Library. Isn't that human nature? Isn't that human nature? See, our giving is not just money. As a matter of fact, frankly, money is the least significant thing, especially for us here. We don't have a money problem. None of us have any. And our service to the community has not been pumping large amounts of money to anybody. But God has dumped food on us. Leon brings boxes of food. We have a difficult time sometimes finding everybody who would like to have it. I think we're pretty much caught up right now. See, giving is not just money, it's time. It's resources. We give money because it's easy. It's easy. So Carl's got a thing in the bulletin about taking a day of December and bringing something, some commodity. Yeah, that's good. Don't put your name on the box. Did you notice the qualifications for elders in 1 Timothy 3, beginning with verse 1? One qualification of being a leader in the church is, quote, unquote, not a lover of money. And must not be a recent convert, or he may be conceited. See, we do not understand that when you give, you're the one that benefits more than anyone else. So don't be a cautious disciple. Matthew 26, beginning in verse 57, says, those who had arrested Jesus took him to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the teachers of the law and elders had assembled. But Peter followed him at a distance, right up to the courtyard of the high priest. Where would I have been? The local vigilantes have come and dragged Jesus away to kill him. And Peter is cautious. I guess I would have been too. I wish I could say I had the courage to stand up and say, no, no, this is wrong, this is unjust. No, I probably don't. Paul said in Romans 1, verse 16, I am not ashamed of the gospel because it is the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes. Am I embarrassed to tell somebody I go to church? Good question. It took me a long time in my secular employment to say I believe in God. When people in my high school found out I was a believer in God, they insisted that I give a presentation to the student body in a thing called mini courses about why I believed. It was a great opportunity, but it scared me to death. Here I was, high school of 2,000 students, and faculty members waiting to find a way to embarrass me. cautious. Cautious because we sometimes are embarrassed and have a lack of courage to teach what the Bible says about sexual purity, about marriage, and why God expects us as Christians to abstain from sexual relationships until there is marriage. About abortion. About the use of substance, alcohol, meth, marijuana. Big issue right now in our area. We must not have hobbies. One issue wonders. But we also must not confuse the methods of doing good with social issues. We cannot be cautious. So if we put on the sign, come on January the 9th and hear how we can know there is a God, is that going to embarrass you? Are you going to be willing to take this brochure, if we do this, and hand it to a friend or a neighbor? Or is that going to cause you to be very cautious? And finally, we need to be committed disciples. I've told you, some of you, this story before. You talk about your kids hitting you between the eyes. Many years ago, back at the Donmar Avenue Church of Christ in South Bend, the elders said to the congregation, we're trying to plan a budget. So would you guys fill out one of these cards and tell us what you think your contribution will be able to be in the coming year? Okay. And I thought it was a good teaching opportunity, so I sat my three kids down and I said, okay, you guys, here's what we're doing. What are you doing? And my daughter Kathy, who I think was 5 at the time, said, Daddy, I went back and I think I can give 75 cents a week. I said, well, Kathy, that's amazing. Yeah, but how are you going to do that? Your allowance is only 50 cents a week. I remember this was a long time ago. And she said, well, Daddy, I emptied out my piggy bank and I can take 25 cents a week out and I can make 75 cents a week. And I thought, oh, man. Am I a committed disciple? Whereas my 5-year-old got a lot better concept of how giving serves than I do. What are you planning to do in this new year with 168 hours a week of time, should God give you that much? You have an idea what would happen if each of us gave 10% of 168 hours a week? Man, we'd have to build a new building within a year. And this relates to what kind of a disciple we are. You remember what the last thing was that Jesus did on this earth as a physical being? John 19, beginning of verse 25. When Jesus saw his mother there and his disciple whom he loved standing nearby, he said to his mother, Dear woman, here is your son. And he said to the disciple, Here is your mother. And from that time on, the disciple took her into his home. That was John's discipleship. As long as Mary lived, John served her. You say, I can't teach a class. You say, I can't preach. I can't lead singing. I'm scared to death to stand up and conduct a communion service. Okay. But you can serve. Every time after services we go out there, I see Willard loading up his car with two or three people that need rides. That's discipleship. That's discipleship. Every week I see Carl out there loading up that sign for the visitors in the community to hear a message from. That's discipleship. Every week I pick up a bulletin and I read about people I need to send a card to, make a phone call to. That's Julie. That's discipleship. I watched Richard Hoyt minister to his mother-in-law for years and suffer some abuse. That's discipleship. Jesus wants us to be committed disciples, so he says, foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to bury his head. So I urge you, as we look at a new year coming up, to get involved in discipleship. Don't look back. Don't wait until everything falls in perfect alignment to begin your service to God. We just sang a song a few minutes ago, "Anywhere with Jesus I would safely go." Really? Really? Did you really mean that? Anywhere with Jesus I would safely go. Anywhere he leads me in this world below. Be a disciple, an active, growing, learning, outgoing, open, trained service of God. And as we sing this closing song, think about the message to you in your own life. Let's close by singing the song Carl has selected. Let's sing.